It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, more and more Native American women in the U.S. and Canada are stepping up to learn and teach about traditional birth methods of their tribes. We'll find out why coming up. First, Wisconsin is experiencing a nasty flu season, and it could be getting worse. The CDC upgraded the state's flu outbreak to severe as of this morning. According to the State Department of Health Services, nearly 100 people are being hospitalized with the flu daily. Nationwide, the figures are pretty bad, too. The seasonal total so far is up to more than 74,000 lab-confirmed cases. The number could be a lot higher since a lot of people don't seek medical help when they're sick. Megan Meller is with us now. She's an infection preventionist for Gunderson Health. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Well, thank you.
Well, I don't want to paint a too dire a picture here. In the scope of flu seasons past, how are we looking this year, Megan?
We're looking more severe compared to our average years, definitely.
And what kind of things are you seeing here in Wisconsin and at your practice?
We're seeing a lot more hospitalized cases than we have in years past. And we were seeing hospitalized cases earlier. So we were seeing them starting back in October, which is pretty early for the flu season.
And what do we know about the strains of flu, the kinds of flu that are causing us trouble this year?
This year, the prominent strain is H3N2, which has historically been known to be associated with more severe flu-like symptoms. And it also tends to target our pediatric population as well as our elderly population a little bit harder compared to H1N1.
And do we have figures on how many people have died so far in Wisconsin as a result of this flu this year?
We don't have those numbers yet, but we do have the numbers of number of people, you know, age ranges of who's being infected, like who's being impacted. And we're seeing, again, that people like pediatric or especially under the age of 10 are being really affected by this and over the age of 65.
And Megan, I want to talk about symptoms and what to watch for. And I always bring this up when we talk about the flu. I think a lot of people in their head think flu and they think stomach flu. When we're talking about influenza, we're talking about flu season. It's not the stomach stuff, right?
No, exactly. I mean, the flu we're talking about, the influenza, can be associated with some gastrointestinal symptoms, but we're seeing more of the achy muscles, fatigue, headaches, sneezing, coughing, more of those symptoms, and a fever compared to the nausea, the diarrhea.
And I think a tricky thing for a lot of people is, do I have a really bad cold or do I have a flu? How can we suss that out?
It tends to be more if you have the flu, you're going to be a lot more, you're going to feel a lot more achy and you're going to have the fever compared to if you have a cold or you're just going to kind of feel a little bit unwell under the weather. But we always say, especially if you're a child or if you have underlying, you know, health conditions, that if over-the-counter medication is not alleviating any of your symptoms, it's best just to go make an appointment with your doctor right away and just get those symptoms evaluated because then they can make that ultimate decision.
So for kids or people with underlying health conditions, they're maybe the first people who should be thinking about calling the doctor. How about adults without underlying health conditions? Because we've seen cases of fatalities for apparently otherwise healthy people. When should they be saying, I better get myself over to urgent care?
If their symptoms are worsening. With these high-profile cases, it has been known to happen with influenza. We're seeing it happen now, but it's rare compared to the majority of cases that we're seeing. That said, influenza can open you up to a lot of secondary infections, and that's what state officials are worried about. So especially, you know, with some kids, they have influenza, it seems like they're recovering, and then all of a sudden they just get really sick, and it turns out that they have pneumonia or they have some other really bad bacterial infection. And so what we're looking for is, like if you're feeling short of breath, if nothing, you're just not feeling any better and it's been a couple days, it's definitely best to, if you're feeling short of breath, to go into the emergency room and they will get you the treatment you need.
And how about people who aren't quite there, they pretty clearly have the flu, but maybe not enough to seek medical help? What is your home care advice for people in that situation?
Definitely stay home. So we are seeing some people in the community wanting to tough it out and go into work. They don't want to use their PTO for sick days, or, you know, they're going to family events and they're still feeling sick. And so what we strongly advise people is, if you're feeling under the weather, it's best just to stay home and take care of yourself. Give your body some time to fight off the infection. So, you know, that means by resting, getting plenty of fluids in, and trying to eat. That said, if you can't do either of those things because you're just too sick, you're best just going into urgent care right away.
Megan Meller is with us from Gunderson Health. We're talking about this year's flu season. Now the CDC says it is a severe season in Wisconsin. That's as of this morning. Let's talk about vaccines. Megan, how effective are they this year against this main strain of flu that we're seeing?
So we won't know exactly how effective this vaccine is until the end of the season when scientists and public health officials can evaluate all the data. But right now it's looking to be about 30% effective against this current circulating strain.
And people will hear that and say, that doesn't sound that great. Is it still worth it to have gotten vaccinated or to get vaccinated now if we haven't yet?
Oh, absolutely. Having the vaccine, while you can still get the flu from after having being vaccinated, the vaccine can still protect you from having really severe symptoms, and it can also shorten the duration of your illness. And so it still offers protection against the flu.
And people might say, I wish I'd gotten it back in the fall. It's too late now, right? Are they right?
It is definitely not too late now. While many flu clinics are currently closed, there's currently no vaccine shortages. And so we're advising our community and all of our patients to still make appointments with their providers to get the shots, or they can go to their local pharmacy. And it's never too late because this flu season will probably carry on until, early spring, even though they'll be tapering off then, but you can get the flu at any point during that. So definitely go get your flu shot if you haven't yet, because that's going to be your best protection against it this year.
Now, when it comes to not spreading this disease and trying not to catch it ourselves, do things like the hand washing and the sneezing into our elbow and all that, do they really make a difference?
They really do. It's all about being mindful of your surroundings. So, if you're sneezing into open air, those virus particles can hang out in the air, for a substantial amount of time. So you could leave and someone else could walk in and breathe that in. That, if you're sneezing into your hands, it's best to wash your hands right afterwards or use alcohol, because you can then touch surfaces and then someone else can come through and expose themselves. Same thing in the workplace when we see, people are, working in cubicles or, clustered close together and they're not going outside because it's cold. It's all about being aware of your environment and trying to reduce transmission.
And let's talk about medication. The flu, it's a virus, so antibiotics won't do anything. Are those antivirals out there? Are they something that will be prescribed for some people?
Absolutely. So one of the main antivirals out there is Tamiflu, and that is given within 48 hours of first symptoms. And so that's, again, where if you have a child who's starting to show some symptoms or underlying health conditions, if you go see a provider right away and they suspect the flu, they will give you Tamiflu right away. So that way, if your results come back, you can start taking that and then help, alleviate some of the symptoms.
And Megan, as we start to wrap up, you started to touch on this already, but we were declared severe in Wisconsin earlier today by the CDC. What are we watching for in the coming days and weeks with the progress of this flu?
We're watching for whether cases are increasing, especially hospitalized cases. So hospitalized cases are reportable according to Wisconsin law. And so every day, whenever we have a hospitalized case, we report that directly to the state. And so that's what they're calculating right now. So what we're looking for is, are the number of hospitalized cases are they stabilizing, are they decreasing, or are they actually increasing? So that's what we're keeping an eye out for.
We'll leave it there for now. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking to Megan Meller. She's an infection preventionist for Gunderson Health. She joined us today to talk about the flu here in Wisconsin. The CDC upgraded the state's flu outbreak to severe. That news came out earlier today. Many Native American women in the U.S. and Canada are choosing to revisit and learn about their tribe's traditional birthing methods. For many tribes and indigenous people, a birth is a time for spiritual practice and ceremony. Our guest says that forcing Native women to have their babies in the westernized hospital system can limit their rights and abilities to practice important cultural traditions. Doreen Day is a member of the Ojibwe tribe of northern Minnesota. She's an Ondandizikekwe, or one who helps life come into the world. She's been teaching and practicing birth work for decades. Doreen, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'd like to do a greeting.
Yes, please.
Bonjour, Nindwemaganidug, Wabano Quendishinakaz, Wabajeshin Dudame, and Adizike Quendel.
And can you tell me what that greeting meant, please?
Well, that greeting said, hello, my name is Daybreak Woman. I'm from the Martin clan, and I'm Undadizike Kwe is a midwifery woman, or I'm a midwife.
And that's a lot of the work you've been doing for years now. Tell us what Native American women were encountering when they went into hospitals for childbirth. What sorts of problems were you and others seeing there?
Well, if I can go back to 1942 when the law changed requiring Indigenous women from reservations to go to the Indian Health Service hospitals to deliver, there wasn't a sterile field then, so there was a lot of infection, a lot of sickness around childbirth. As of recent, there are different standards. Of course, we have sterile field, but there are still other issues that are impacting Indian women that are giving birth in the hospital.
Right. What are some of those issues that you see that you're trying to help solve?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is the interference of a natural birth. Many things that are standardized or that are now considered best practices for labor and delivery are very intrusive according to our traditional way of giving birth. So, for example, a Native woman would not be able to be about, walk around, do her squats, do the things that are, you know, going to bring the labor on by that continual movement and, you know, rhythm of her body. But oftentimes she's, the first thing that happens is a fetal monitor is put on a woman, and therefore then she doesn't have that natural movement ability. That's a big issue for many Indigenous women.
So what should it look like when you are working with women who are pregnant and getting ready to give birth? What traditional practices do you look for that will work better?
Well, I think one of the main things is eating a traditional diet, which our bodies are accustomed to. You know, we came on a long migration from the East Coast, and so Anishinaabe people, we rely on Minoman or wild rice as a staple to our diet. So we have a different type of diet, and I encourage Native women to eat their traditional and natural foods. A lot of movement, a lot of walking, a lot of learning how to relax. Those are some of the things that that are really necessary to have a natural, uncomplicated birth.
Can you talk about your role as an Undadizikekwe? What do you do? What does that mean?
Well, an Undadizikekwe is one that helps with birth. And myself, I was trained by a traditional midwife, Gudgee Cook, from the Mohawk Nation when I was a young woman. And so being that I was trained, I was hand-selected. A group of four women were hand-selected for the kind of commitment that we would make to continue doing this work. And so we did train under traditional midwifery very intensively, and then we began practicing that here in Minnesota, which I still do. Importantly, though, that the women had, what I had found at a young age is women turned themselves over to Western medicine. Therefore, having not been taught about traditional birthing or the spiritual or cultural practices that accompanied that, they basically did whatever the Western medicine provider said. And so a lot of those practices that we have to have a baby had pretty much almost went non-existent. So my work is to bring that back, bring the cultural, spiritual aspect of birth back to Indigenous women if they so desire that.
Right. As I understand it, the Western method of childbirth focuses on the body. You're also hoping to talk about the mind and the spirit and the cultural heritage as a part of childbirth.
Yes. One of the things that's very, very important to live a good life is, as Anishinaabe, we understand where we come from, that we have a creation story we have a wealth of knowledge that accompanies that creation story that really lended itself to our good way of life, Mino Bema Diziwin. And so that is the auspice of teaching Indigenous women of all ages to gravitate back toward reclaiming those practices toward having a good life. So as you know, being a teacher, that's a primary role that I provide. When we look at mind, body, spirit, also your heart, that's a holistic approach that we entertain all of the important things of life: your health, your well-being, your mind, you know, your spirit, and of course your body. And so, so that's a very important holistic approach to providing good medical care and good spiritual care, good emotional care for a woman that's going to have a baby.
Can you tell us a little bit about the spiritual practices that might be involved during childbirth?
Okay. An Indigenous woman that's having a baby would want to have a ceremony. So this is our teaching from a long time ago, that birth was not just delivering a baby per se, but there is a spiritual aspect to it. So when a woman is having a baby, there's a spiritual grounding that takes place. Everything is ceremonial. There are songs that are sung. There are offerings of tobacco that are made. There are prayers that are said on behalf of the birth of the spirit of the one coming here to come to this physical life. Much like there's a ceremony for those that are going, returning back to the spirit world, there's a fire and a ceremony. Also, as with birth, there's a fire and a ceremony for the spirit to come here. So it's an acknowledgement of the spirit, an acknowledgement of the life that's coming. Very important to do. Sometimes in a medical atmosphere, there's a hindrance to getting those, to be able to do those things, although that may be changing a little.
We're talking to Doreen Day. She's a member of the Ojibwe tribe of northern Minnesota and is an Onda Dizikekwe, or one who helps life come into the world. We're talking about bringing back Native American childbirth practices. Did I read that one of the first things that happens after the child is born, that their feet are touched to the earth?
Yes.
What is the meaning of that?
That's a holistic grounding of that spirit, who then becomes a human after he or she is born and meets their true mother, our Mother Earth. So it's a grounding to the earth, for she is the true mother, as many tribes believe.
You mentioned that some things might be changing in hospitals. Is it possible for you as an Onda Dizikekwe to attend at a hospital birth and do at least some of these practices?
I have attended I have 11 sisters. I've attended all of their births, well, most all of them. I've attended many nieces and relatives' births in the hospital. It's a challenge because, Western medicine really dictates how birth goes. And so it sometimes can be a tooth and nail fight to even have the smudge or have the singing or have the drum or have the flute music or have the ability to walk about and to be with a lot of people. Those are the things that are common for Anishinaabe, for Indigenous people. And so how I believe that they're changing is that they are willing to sometimes listen to a birth plan that's written by a family, and they will allow those things, but it takes a lot of effort to secure that kind of practice.
Our hospital is getting more open to that, at least?
I think so. I think that there has always been a need in the Western medical field to train individuals that are healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, practitioners, because they don't really understand that we have this holistic approach. They don't understand a mistrust that has been with our people all the way back to the treaties that were signed and the things that were promised and were not delivered. So there's a general mistrust of the medical system. Some elders don't go to the hospital until, it's almost too late. And so for some things, going into a medical facility, it may be a necessity. But for birth, certainly 85% of our young women don't need to give birth by C-section. And that's the kind of awareness that needs to be brought about. To give people the information that they need to make their own informed decisions about how they're going to birth their babies.
I know over many decades there were efforts by the United States and Canadian governments to and a lot of Native American cultural practices, language, spirituality, you name it. And I've heard from guests that that created a disruption that, that hurts people down through the generations. How important is it for you that you're starting new lives, bringing back those traditions?
It's very important because we have the ability to heal ourselves. We still have practitioners that know the medicines, that know the processes for health. And so we do have great abilities in our communities. We have spiritual healing that's being practiced. We have midwifery. We have, you know, sovereignty for food and for birth. We have all of these things happening, and they should be happening because we have suffered under the disease model created by the policies of U.S. governments, both in the U.S. and in Canada. And we're trying to change that. We're trying to stand up for ourselves and do what the Creator gave us, follow the road, follow the life, follow the teachings that were given to our people on this continent. We know that we were placed here by the Creator. We didn't come from someplace else, and that's a very important thing.
It's a good place to leave it. Doreen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Doreen Day is a member of the Ojibwe tribe of northern Minnesota. She's an Ondan Dizikekwe, or one who helps life come into the world. She joined us to talk about the revival of traditional birth among Native American women. It's Food Friday, and here at Central Time, we thought it might be a good time to go back to basics. This week, we're looking at tips for people who are new to the kitchen. Our own in-house foodies are going to be sharing things they wish they had known when they started cooking, and we hope you'll share your own essential cooking advice, too. Call in at 800-642-1234. What is your best advice for a new or learning kitchen cook, and what do you wish you had known when you got started that you know now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is a big cook herself. She sometimes makes stuff for us here on the Central Time team. Hey, Judith.
Hey, Rob. Good to be here.
Let's get it started. We've got some clips to play from cooks and our colleagues here, but what was on your mind when you started thinking about great advice for new cooks?
Sure. One of the most important things, I think, is make sure you have sharp knives. Don't use a dull knife. If you're like me and somewhat accident prone in the kitchen, dull knives, much worse cuts. Clean cuts come from sharp knives. Also, you're less likely to cut yourself if you have a good sharp knife because it goes through whatever you're cutting a lot easier, and you don't have to use as much muscle.
And a follow-up tip, if you sharpen knives, let anybody else who uses those knives know they're sharpened, because I've been burned on that one before. The knife I expected to be dull, and I cut a good clean cut with that sharp knife.
Yes, but a cut nonetheless.
Here's one that people have been saying over the years, food safety people, cooks, whatever, get a meat thermometer.
Yes.
They're cheap. They're good digital ones. I finally got one that I like using. And the great thing is, I'm paranoid about cooking meat. The thing I did without a meat thermometer was I overcooked everything, and now I cook things right, and this is amazing. They're way better.
They are. They're not as dry.
Well, I want to give a listen to Chris Kimball now. He was on the show not too long ago, Milk Street Kitchen guy. You know him, Chris Kimball.
Yep.
You hear him on our airwaves. Here is him talking some about some spice basics.
Here is one of my revelations, which, wasn't brilliant. It came to me late, but, I've cooked out of Mastering the Art of French Cooking since it came out almost. And I was thinking, how many spices were used in that book? Almost none. How many herbs? Four or five, with the small amounts. How many chilies? None. How much ginger? None. How much fermented sauce? So the world has at its disposal in different places all sorts of big flavors, right? So I would say there are four or five spices you should have. You don't have to go crazy. Cumin and coriander being sort of the two. Smoked paprika, maybe turmeric, maybe a different kind of pepper. but cumin certainly in the Middle East is the black pepper of the Middle East. They use salt and cumin, not salt and pepper. So half a dozen spices. A good soy sauce and a good fish sauce are really helpful. And having some dried chilies around, which you can get at almost any supermarket these days, like a New Mexico chili, which isn't that spicy, is great. And then, when you go shopping, buy, some lots of herbs. We just did a recipe here that had 2 cups of cilantro, 2 cups of parsley, and 1 cup of dill. So just by upping the amount of herbs you use, you can completely change a recipe. For example, lots of places in the world when they do chicken soup, they'll throw in a couple handfuls of herbs at the end, handfuls. So it's not always a question of having something different. It's just using more of it.
Chris Kimmel there from Milk Street Kitchen. We're sharing cooking advice, cooking basics, and you can share your advice for new cooks at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers. Derek is with us in Galesville. Derek, hi.
Hi.
What's your advice, Derek?
I have advice for peeling eggs.
Ooh, it's a tough one for me.
So you take a container and fill about, a quarter way with water, and then you shake it, and the egg peel will come right off.
You shake the egg in the water, like shake it so it's like bouncing off the sides of the container, that kind of shake?
Yeah.
And that peels right off. Okay, Derek, thank you so much for
that. Rob's going to try that.
I am cursed, I think, with boiling eggs and trying to peel them cleanly.
Especially when you want them to be a whole egg.
Right, you want them to be
pretty.
It
never works. Like if you're trying to make deviled eggs, always ends up as egg salad for me. But what I have learned, Robin, and thanks for that tip, Derek, is that actually the fresher the egg, the harder it's going to be to peel if it's a hard-boiled egg. So if you, for instance, have friends that have chickens, don't get the eggs from them and try to hard boil them right away. Actually, the ones that have maybe been at the store in your fridge for a week or two peel much more easily.
Thanks so much for that call, Derek, at 800-642-1234. Here's one from our colleague Jill of Larry Mueller's show fame. This is one I was going to mention myself. Read the if you're working from a recipe,
yes,
read the entire recipe before starting. I got burned on that a couple times. It was some kind of potato. It might have been a scalloped potato recipe. Cooking, I see a bake for 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I time it. I back time it like radio people do.
Yep.
I'm going to have it ready for dinner. I'm halfway through the recipe. Pull out of the oven. Do a thing. Bake for 30 minutes in addition to that 60. So there, boom, dinner's half an hour later than planned.
Right. And I would also say that don't assume that you have the staples that are called for in a recipe on hand. Really actually go and look that you have everything, because if you're like me, you use the last of something that you buy maybe only once or twice a year and you forget to go get more. So read through the recipe, make sure you have all the ingredients you're assuming you're having, and make sure you're doing the timing right.
We are sharing cooking advice for new cooks, people maybe early on in their kitchen careers trying it for the first time, or, you know, developing through the years. I'm still learning a lot on Food Friday. You can join in with your advice at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Marsha on Facebook. She says, get yourself a couple of great basic cookbooks like The Joy of Cooking or the Betty Crocker cookbook. Once you've mastered something, give it your own personal spin. I still have a Betty Crocker cookbook that one of my aunts gave me when I first moved into an apartment and had a kitchen. Huge stuff I still flip open and go back to X number of years later. I'm not naming numbers here. Were you a Betty Crocker person at any point?
So, yes, and I actually have a book that I still use. I am in my early 50s, and I have a book that's called The Cook-Along Book. It's a kid's cookbook that is geared towards kids cooking with their parents. There are at least 3 or 4 recipes in that cookbook that I still make as an adult. And
fantastic.
They are just great, basic. And I get a kick out of them, too, because in the middle, all of a sudden, in all capital letters, it'll say, be careful with that knife, or have you washed your hands recently? But the cookbook is so much worse for the wear, but I still, there's a beef stew in there. Every time I want to make it, I go to that.
And it's still good advice for grown-ups, too.
Yes.
We'll go to Bob in La Crosse now. Bob, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What advice do you have, Bob?
One thing I learned early on was switching between a gas stove and electric stove. It can be very different. So if you learn and do something well one way and have to switch devices, you have to adjust your techniques a little bit when you're switching between those.
Yeah, I've done almost all gas cooking in my life, and it's a little learning curve when I'm somewhere and I use an electric stove. Any tips on how to make that jump?
It's just always thinking with electric stoves, the heat transfer is always going to be slower. So if you're turning something down, turn it down a little bit sooner. With a gas stove, it's almost an instantaneous change. With electric, the residual heat stays on a whole lot longer. So it's slower to heat up and slower to cool down.
Exactly. And that's a great tip, Bob, because I had grown up on gas, and then in my first apartment, it was electric. And I turned something off assuming it was going to stop cooking and it didn't. So that's really great advice. Thanks so much for that advice, Bob, at 800-642-1234. Let's go next to Joe in Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
What's your advice?
I've learned how to make gravy that never fails. There's a couple ways to make gravy. You can add the flour to the a little bit of grease that's left in a roasting pan, or you can pour off all the grease and just let the grease that clings to the bottom of the pan in there, and then add your flour to some water in a jar and shake it, and then add that to the roasting pan. So using cold water helps dissolve the flour, and you don't get lumps.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that. Good gravy advice. Yeah, gravy is one of those I always hesitate sometimes to make. I think it's harder than it is. We asked around here at the studio. We heard from Dean Knetter, Central Time producer. He says oil for heat, butter for flavor. Here's a listen.
The cooking tip that I wish I had known a long time ago was oil for heat, butter for flavor. Use it when making eggs, vegetables, just about anything. You heat them up with the oil, and if you want to actually taste them, get some butter in there.
That's good advice, and there's some things I'll only fry, like pancakes, I'm going to make them in butter. Eggs, I'm going to make them in butter, because that's part of the flavor that I'm looking for there.
So actually, what I do with those really nice big sea scallops is I was taught to make it with half oil and half butter, because you can get the higher heat with the, I use canola oil, but the butter just gives it that really great flavor, and the and a little bit of browning. And so, yeah, I hadn't really thought about doing both together, but you can get a little bit out of both.
We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Teresa is with us in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hey, hi. How are you doing?
Good. What's your advice?
I agree with you. Always make sure you read the recipe. But one thing that has helped me a lot, and also teaching my husband and my kids to cook, was to make sure that you always get all your ingredients, put them on the counter, and as you use them, put them away. That way you avoid doubling up on something or mistakenly putting in, say, a cup of salt rather than a cup of sugar.
That can make a big difference. Thank you so much for that. And I'm a big fan of that. And it also, if you're at that critical stage when something's cooking along and you need to add the next thing and you're fumbling around looking for it, that'll save you that.
And Kate on Facebook actually said, my mom would have said, clean as you go.
Oh, I do that.
But she says, her motto is, find someone who will clean if you cook. So that's also a good thing. Yeah, and that's, you know, because sometimes it is the cleanup after that makes you think, I don't want to make this complicated recipe. But hey, if you share
the load.
If
you've got time while it's baking, too, you can clean up. We're sharing cooking advice and tips for people who are maybe new to the kitchen on this edition of Food Friday. Judith Sears-Poisson, executive producer at Central Time, is here with us. And you too, if you want, at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tell us what you wish you knew when you first started cooking. What do you wish somebody had told you? Or did you get great advice early on that made a big difference for you? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday conversation with cooking advice for beginners. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson is in the studio, and you can join in with your cooking advice at 800-642-1234. What do you think people should know as they get started? What do you wish you had known? We asked around the WPR studios for some advice. It wasn't always fancy. Here's Carl Christensen.
One of the first cooking tips I taught my 2-year-old son was, if you're ever going to make a frozen pizza, always open it up over the sink so that any cheese that falls off, it'll just be right there already near the garbage disposable for a quick cleanup.
It's good advice. I have teenagers in my house. I wish I'd thought of that years ago.
Well, we have Max in Two Rivers on the line who has a pizza tip too, so let's go there. Hi, Max.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you have to tell us?
So I got two tips here. First tip, pretty quick. If you guys are making a cake out of a box or cornbread and you want it a bit sweeter, replace water with apple juice. And then by doing that, you can kind of pull some of the sugar from it, too. So it's not as sugary. And it gives it a nice, moist taste, and it's not so bland.
Nice.
The other tip I would let everybody know is pizza stones are incredibly expensive, in my opinion. But for a fraction of the cost, you can go to your local hardware store and pick up some terracotta tiles and cover the bottom of your rack in your oven, and that'll perform the same function as the pizza stone.
That's great. MaxEgg says non-glazed tiles for people listening. If you do that, I've heard that advice a couple of times. Max, thank you so much for sharing that. And let's go back to our callers. Kim is with us in Wazika. Kim, hi.
Hello. How are you this afternoon?
Good. What did you want to tell us, Kim?
I think everyone should learn how to make a basic white sauce.
Okay.
Basic white sauce is your foundation for an Alfredo sauce, scalloped potatoes, macaroni and cheese, and you can change each one of them. Now, I know tonight I'm going to make clam chowder for supper, and that's how I start, is with a basic white sauce.
Huh.
So that's a staple for so many things. And the other thing is, in your spice cabinet, most people, and my children have been very surprised to find when they go to other people's houses that they have salt and pepper.
So you're kind of going with the Chris Kimball idea of there's a lot of great seasonings and spices and herbs out there that can really bump up the flavor on things.
Yes. Growing up, my mother had a massive herb garden, and we put up herbs for the winter. Mm. You know, we'd use them fresh in the summer, and we'd have them all winter. But dry mustard, mustard powder, in eggs, whether they're scrambled eggs or you put them in deviled eggs or in macaroni and cheese. It adds another dimension to the flavor.
Great. Kim, thank you so much for that. We are taking your cooking advice for new cooks at 800-642-1234.
And, you know, Rob, we were talking earlier about cleaning as you go and things like that. Christine on Facebook actually wrote, her advice is sing and don't be afraid of messing up the kitchen. And, you know, if you're using a recipe, select one with the least amount of steps. She thinks overcomplication is what drives people away from cooking. Yeah, you don't have to jump in on the most complex thing. We talked with Brianne Chasso, who is a WPR fill-in producer, and this is what she had to say.
My cooking tip is to read the instructions first. I've always thought of myself as being a pretty good cook, but I prepared my first Thanksgiving dinner for a crowd this year alone. Thought, you know, oh, it's this many pounds of turkey, it'll thaw in this amount of time, and I didn't really read the instructions. So, of course, it's the morning of the dinner that I'm hosting, and my turkey is as frozen as it can be. So I went through emergency tips from my mom, but ultimately had to run out and buy a fresh turkey. And I ultimately had 30 pounds of turkey cooked by the end of that weekend.
Well, we know what Brianne was eating, probably still eating after that. You know, and actually, turkey is a great one to throw in advice that I learned the hard way as a teenager making a Thanksgiving dinner. There is, in most turkeys, a plastic bag full of giblets, and you need to take that out.
Uh-oh.
In order to not have cooked plastic in the middle of your meal. So stick your hand in there, feel around, especially as you're thawing it. When it's frozen, it might be hard to tell that there is something in there, but especially as it's thawing, stick your hand in there and make sure there's not a bag of goodies.
Don't bake the plastic. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Nancy, hi.
Well, hello. I just wanted to say, well, I'm an old gal, you know, and I've got a lot of old recipe books, and a lot of them have, when you're making bread, scald the milk. Well, that was years ago when you got the milk out of the milk can in the farm, you know, because it was raw milk. But now everything is pasteurized, so you don't have to scald the milk anymore. You can just get it lukewarm, so when you put your yeast in there, you know, it's going to be the right temperature. But that's for people who are learning how to bake bread with old cookbooks.
Nancy, thank you so much for sharing this. Yeah, I can imagine a lot of people baking bread and wanting a classic cookbook,
right.
And yeah, getting that unnecessary advice to scald that raw milk, which isn't raw,
right,
for the most
part
these days.
Great, yeah, you know, a lot of, yeah, especially those kind of vintage recipes, I never really thought about that the products actually change. one of our Facebook followers, Elizabeth, said, just get cooking. At first, cook following recipes that call for unprocessed foods, then experiment. And she says an America's Test Kitchen type of book with recipes with lots of explanations help. And she's also on the Clean As You Go advice train.
I want to listen now to Noah Ovshinsky. He's our news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and he's a big food fan, a big cook himself. Here's a listen to his advice.
Two hacks that I tell people. First, buy large eggs. When you go to the supermarket, you sometimes have a choice of different sizes. Always buy large eggs. Most, if not all, recipes that you'll find online or in books are designed using large eggs. My number two hack is always buy unsalted butter. I should say always cook with unsalted butter so that you maintain, as a cook, ultimate control over the seasoning. So you cook your dish, and at the end, you then add salt to you or your fellow eater's liking.
That's pretty good. I'm pretty modest with the salt for the most part. Mm-hmm. So using salted butter usually gives me most of what I needed. But maybe I'll try that with the unsalted butter.
And I would say, you know, there's most things benefit from a little bit of salt. You can actually get some really interesting salts. I got, as a part of kind of a gift basket, smoked salt. It is amazing. So you get the saltiness, but then you also get this little smoky flavor. So, you know, look for some interesting salts along with those interesting spices and herbs that we were talking about.
And one more piece of advice that I would have for new cooks is don't be afraid to take shortcuts or take the easy way out early on. You can get fancy later on. So with, you know, early on when I'd make soup, and soup is a great thing for beginning cooks, I'd be like, oh, should I feel bad that I'm not going to try to make my own stock and do it all the way? No, don't feel bad. That can take a long time. Mm-hmm. Get whatever you like. Bouillon cubes. I like the better than bouillon glop that you spoon
in. Yes, I love that too.
Some people use stock. It's not cheating. There's nothing wrong with it. And then you can really tweak it to your flavor or to your desires then. And it's a good fast way to get started on soup.
And you know what else is a really good tweak that no one needs to feel badly about is frozen vegetables if you're cooking, especially something like a soup or a
especially stuff. In the winter when stuff may not be in season.
Yes. And, you know, especially now the freezing techniques there, it's really as good as fresh. If you're going to cook it anyway, start with the frozen. You can actually get organic pretty cheaply. It's easy to portion out so you don't have to worry about wasting. So go for the frozen.
And another, speaking of frozen, actually, quiche is something that looks really impressive. You don't have to make your own crust. It's okay to buy the pre-frozen crust. And if you're starting with that, it's incredibly easy, especially thin, not a deep dish. It bakes up. Deep dish can take a long time to bake. That thin crust, you can make four of them, cook up the veggies, bacon, whatever, and it's a showstopper and really pretty quick and easy.
Another good tip that I have is if often I'm making two or three things because I want leftovers or I want to cook for the week. If most of the things have garlic or onions or maybe carrots or celery, cook it all together and then just portion it out instead of, you know, doing a little bit and then starting over. You know, look at those. Don't just read the first recipe. Read all the recipes. And then you've got a start on all the dishes.
Judith, thanks a lot for joining in.
Absolutely.
On this. A lot of fun. And thanks to all of you for your calls and your advice. You can keep sharing your advice for new cooks early in their career. Cooks to help out in the kitchen. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page and see what other people have to offer as well. Again, tell us what you wish you knew when you started cooking over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. There's a new Derek Smalls album coming out, and he's lined up a lot of top-level talent to play along with him. Who's Derek Smalls? He's the fictional bass player for the fictional band and documentary subject, Spinal Tap. He's better known as Harry Shearer in real life, and he's got a new real-life album coming out. Guest musicians include names like Peter Frampton, Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, Richard Thompson, Donald Fagen, who's been on the show, by the way, from Steely Dan, Dweezil Zappa, Frank Zappa's son, a pretty good guitarist himself. It's due out April 13th. This one's from the press release here. It's a poignant and oftentimes furious contemplation on aging that explores the passing of time and all things loud. So I don't know if you're a Spinal Tap fan like I am. I grew up at the right time, and I'm a guy in a band, so Spinal Tap is kind of a core reference point for a lot of my life. You may remember this one goes to 11, and the drummers who kept exploding. I don't know if there are any big-name drummers on this Derek Smalls album. I'd be a little leery about playing drums with anybody associated with Spinal Tap. And Derek Smalls, he was kind of the... thought he was wise, maybe not that bright. I don't have a track from the new album, but we'll go out with Stonehenge from Spinal Tap on Central Time. Stonehenge, where the